Welcome to Newsworthy with Norrisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Welcome back to the show. Today we have with us from outside of Chicago, Shauna Nyquist. Shauna, how are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. Now, this is two Nyquists in 1 month. This is very special.
That's a lot. You might be overwhelmed with all of us Nyquists.
Yeah, well, I had my dad on once this month. So there's two Norrisworthys, two Nyquists.
Oh, I like it.
Yeah, so we're evening out. I was texting your name or your last name to someone and it auto-corrected as Mosquito.
So, I will literally answer to anything. No one gets the last name right. So Mosquito is closer than some.
Yeah. What's the worst botching of your last name?
Well, the problem is that I have a habit of not correcting people. And it's my married name, so it's not, I don't maybe feel
it's not like a real name. It doesn't really count.
It's not like I didn't like grow up with it from birth, mm-hmm. You know? So it just doesn't bother me when people mispronounce it. But I did an hour long radio interview where she kept saying Shauna Nyquist. And every time she said it, I was like, oh, now I have to correct her. But then it was just too far.
It's too far into it.
60 minutes. And she was one of those people who kind of her technique was saying my full name over and over again. So that was a long hour. Yeah.
Yeah. That's pretty rough. My wife is a nurse. And so she has to sign her name. And her maiden name was Bush, which is a very short, strong, good name. And she hates my last name. She goes, I hate having to sign Norrisworthy all the time. So, yeah, Aaron and I both have not done well to our wives, giving them terrible last names.
Wow. It's the least of my, I mean, being married to Aaron and marrying into his family is such a great thing. I'll take a hard to spell name.
That's good. That's good. Now, speaking of Aaron, he came on the show a few weeks ago and he told a story about y'all's first date. And he said that on your first date, he invited you, went on a date, and you brought a guy friend with you.
I did that, yes.
That really happened?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Even worse, not only was it a guy friend, it was a guy I liked.
Oh, no.
Yeah, yeah.
Shauna.
I know.
What was happening there? Tell me.
I will tell you. And he always leaves out this part of the story. It's not like he came to my house with flowers and looked me in the eye and said, may I take you on a date? Okay. We worked together. We were colleagues. Mm-hmm. He like swings by my cubicle and is like, hey, I heard you say you have to go to such and such store. I have to go to such and such store. They're right by each other. Why don't we go together on Friday? Like, it literally sounded to me like I'm going to Office Max for printer cartridges over lunch. Do you want to jump in the car? Mm. You know, and it did not even occur to me that it was a date. So I thought, like, nice guy from work. We're going to go into the city. Why not make it more fun and bring someone I have a crush on? And I did not know until much later that I got that totally wrong.
Yeah, Aaron conveniently left that part of the story out. Very convenient. Well played, Aaron. Well played. Now, you guys were the first couple to be separately suggested as guests on the show.
Oh, really?
Brian McLaren suggested that I have your husband on. And then, do you know Science Mike?
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
So Mike said, oh, you need to talk to Shauna. And so I had him on the show 2 or 3 months ago. And so I was very excited. Two people, same family. That seemed like a great idea. And so I started researching. And it took me a little while to realize that your dad is a pastor, a well-known pastor. And it's, I don't think that you are like hiding it, but you don't lead with your dad's last name or your family name and what he's done. Is that something that you've been intentional to not let that be your defining factor?
Yeah, I think so. So I've been married for 13 years. Mm-hmm. And then I wrote, my first book came out only like 8 years ago. So, and at the time when I kind of first became a writer, I had worked at Willow for 5 years, then was working at Mars Hill in Grand Rapids. It was just Nyquist was my name. It was the name I just used everywhere. To go back to my maiden name for publishing would have felt like a pretty obvious slash pretty tacky way to kind of call attention to something. practically speaking, I absolutely adore my family. I mm-hmm. love them to pieces. I spend a ton of time with them. They're my best friends. I love Willow. I love being a part of it. I just didn't ever want people to say she's trying to use her name yeah. to get somewhere. It was mm-hmm. really important to me to say, I mean, obviously, of course, I have been given more opportunities than the average person because of my name, even behind the scenes, but I didn't want to publicly use that. You know, so I don't ever want to say like, I got here all on my own. Of course I didn't. Mm-hmm. But I didn't want to, for that to be the first thing that people know about me. But I'm so proud of it. I'm so yeah. proud of my dad. I adore our church. I love being a Hybels. I just also mm-hmm. love our family. I love being a Nyquist. I love being a part of Aaron's family.
Yes. Yeah. Now, I have three daughters, and I'm a pastor, and so I'm always very interested in preachers' daughters that turn out well. Now, I've known you for 5 minutes now, and you seem like you've turned out well.
I have turned out so well.
So I can't say this definitively that you actually have turned out, but it seems like you have. And so I'm always interested, okay, what are the things that pastors do that help their daughters become normal, healthy, fully functioning people? Like, what are some of the things that you see pastors, maybe your dad, that's really made a difference in helping raise daughters?
That's such a good question. And this is actually one I love to talk about because there are a couple things I feel like looking back, my parents did very strategically that really, really helped. I have just one younger brother and he and I are neighbors. We live on the same street. We're very close friends. He's a part of Willow. Our family is really connected and connected to the church. And I feel like that is fairly unusual.
Yeah, it is.
But there's a couple things that they did that really, really helped us. One of them is they made it clear to us and to the church elders that we weren't church staff members. We didn't have to live up to a church staff member code of conduct. We weren't pastors. We weren't ambassadors on behalf of the church. We were kids, and we had to be allowed to be kids. And the thing that I think it's probably tricky, or not tricky, it just, I think pastor parents don't always realize, everybody is treating your kids differently. Everyone.
Yeah.
And you need to be the person who balances that out.
How do you do that?
I think it's by always helping them to feel like their value doesn't rest on what other people think about them. For example, and this is such a silly example, but someone came to my mom. My brother was 6 years old, and someone came to my mom and the Sunday school teacher, and she was like, "Hey, I have to tell you something. I think Todd's not a Christian. I think he's not, I don't think he's a Christian." And my mom was like, "Really? Tell me more." And she said, "Well, when we sing songs to Jesus, he doesn't sing." And my mom was like, he was the shyest, most quiet, most, and really not verbal kid at all. And my mom was like, "He barely talks. Of course he doesn't sing. It's just not in his personality." And she said, she really stood up for him and said, like, "Let's not make assumptions about my kid's spiritual journey. Let's let him be a kid who doesn't sing, and let's let him grow up his own way." And there were other kind of higher stakes issues. There were points for both Todd and I where we didn't want to go to the high school youth ministry anymore. And my parents said, "Okay, why? Let's talk about it and what's going on." And for me, we made a deal. I didn't want to go to the program for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. I had a whole set of reasons. And they said, "We totally get it. We want you to take the space you need. We want you to do your own thing. Will you please continue meeting with a member, a mentor, or a small group leader?"
Yeah.
So they kept me connected to meaningful, wise relationships, but gave me the flex. It wasn't, they never said like, "But what will people think if the pastor's daughter doesn't show up at youth group?" Like yeah. That question, I was waiting for them to ask that question all my life, "But what will people think?" And I would have just been out of there so fast, you know? And they never did. They never made it about what people are going to think. They made it about like, "Tell me about what's happening inside you. Yeah. Tell me about your life. Tell me about your prayer life. Tell me about your questions." And then the other big thing they did is we spent a lot of time together as a family, and they made that a priority. I think it's really easy for pastors' kids to feel like the church comes before the family.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't true for us. Our house was not like open to church family members 7 nights a week. We weren't attending every single service. We weren't like, and we spent very focused time away together. Mm-hmm. When we went on a family vacation, it wasn't with six other church families so that all the dads could talk to my dad about being a pastor. Like it was, they made the four of us time really, really, really valuable. So we felt really seen and known, and like our family unit was not being compromised for the church. And I'm so thankful for how they did that.
Wow, that's good. I was at an event a few months ago, and the guy preaching has a daughter who's one of my wife and I's good friends. The son-in-law is a good friend of mine, and they're sitting on the front row, and I'm at the back of the auditorium, and so I can see the preacher, and then I can see his daughter like on the second or third row watching him, and she's laughing at his jokes. Mm-hmm. Which I thought was so endearing, because after all these years, she's heard the jokes, she's heard the stories, but she's still checked in and engaged when her dad's preaching. Is that something that you can do as someone who's on staff and been a part of Willow for a long period of time?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, the coolest thing now is I teach like 4 times a year at Willow. And it's a really cool thing. Like my dad, he wants to go over my talk with me beforehand. Mm-hmm. And he gives me advice. And then afterwards, he tells me, you know, this tiny little thing and this tiny little thing. And for the next service, try this. And uh-huh. and then I'll do the same with him. When he finishes on Saturday night, I'll go back, you know, to his office and he'll say, okay, any changes for tomorrow? And it's a really very moving thing to get to do a little bit of that together. But yeah, you know, we just had the leadership summit at our church and mm-hmm. my dad always does the opening talk and, he worked so hard on it and he just killed it. It was so good. It was so, and my brother and I literally like almost broke into a run, running back into his office. And he had all these like fancy people that were speaking at the summit and we should have known who they were. And we totally didn't. And we were like, excuse us. Okay, dad, you destroyed it. And this part were great. And I remember you were excited about this. And so totally. I'm super invested in his work, both on the leadership side and the teaching side. And then to have Aaron on staff as well. We share a lot as a family. Like we're very connected to each other's ministry lives. And I really love that.
Do you ever feel like it's too much? Do you ever feel like you need your separate alone Shauna stuff away from family or?
Well, I think that the writing part of my life is that, you know, the book writing part of my life, plenty of space and independence. I mean, it's just me and a laptop, you know? Yeah. So the majority of my work life is totally alone and independent. So then I love when I can connect with my dad or connect with Aaron on something that feels like a really welcome change. And, you know, Aaron and I met working together. We worked together for 10 years. So it was a big change for us to like not be in all the same meetings, you know?
What's mom's role in church? And you talk about you and your brothers going and critiquing dad after sermon. Where's your mom's role in church and family life?
She's way more private. Mm-hmm. Like we joke about it that people have been a part of Willow for, you know, a decade and like couldn't pick her out of a crowd. Yeah. Super private, super low key, and travels a lot internationally. She's really involved in peacemaking in the Middle East yeah. and then in helping women and children specifically in the Congo. Mm-hmm. And so, she's doing like, you know, dad and I are always like, I feel like I go to either Dallas or Orange County once a month to speak at something. Those are like the two places I always end up. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, my mom's like, and then when I was in the West Bank and then when I was in Palestine and we're like, yeah, you're doing really a lot harder work than I am. Yeah. I'm just like complaining about DFW. Yeah. And she's like, well, another thing about the Tel Aviv airport and the screen, I'm like, she's amazing. She's a totally, she's really intense. Mm-hmm. When she feels something, she feels it just totally all the way. And she has been totally captured by peacekeeping and peacemaking in the Middle East and what that means for all of us everywhere. And so she's in the Middle East, you know, 4 or 5 times a year. And so we do have it like we always joke that we should have some sort of master family schedule where we figure out when we're all in town, but it never works. And we end up just kind of chasing each other. Like, where are you right now?
Yeah. Is that how Aaron got interested in mm-hmm. Middle East, your mom?
Maybe. Brian McLaren actually invited both of us on the first trip that Aaron went on. And I think we had a little baby at the time. And so we didn't both feel like we could go. Mm-hmm. And I think my mom had just gotten involved in the Middle East stuff a little bit before that. Mm-hmm. But it's really, I mean, they are like, we joke about it. Like there's no mother-in-law and son-in-law that spend as much time together as Aaron and my mom. They're reading a lot of the same books. They don't go to, they know the same people. Sometimes they, you know, they've been to the Middle East together. Mm-hmm. They'll go to they went to a conference in Washington together. And I was like, Aaron, did you ever think when we were getting married that you would go on trips with my mom? Mm-hmm. But they have real similar personalities.
Okay. It almost sounds obnoxious how awesome your family is. Your family sounds great.
I don't know if we're great. We're close is what we are. We have all sorts of weird little flaws and we, you know, we make a lot of people crazy.
Everyone does. Yeah, of course. Now, one of the things I really respect about you is subject matter for book. I've got a friend who decided to write a book and do a project on the subject of reentry. And so for research for this, he goes up to Barrow, Alaska, where it's negative 65 degrees to do research for this project. You, on the other hand, write a book entitled Bread and Wine. I'm assuming the research for that was way better.
Totally. I'm a genius in that regard. To get to write an entire book about spending time with people you love around the table. Yeah. I loved that process.
I don't know how you convince someone to get behind that, but it's a brilliant idea. I love it. I'm trying to do something about like the waves of God's mercy so I can get someone to pay for me to go to different beaches.
I think it's worth a shot.
Yeah. Well, I know you're going to write another book in the fall, so don't steal that idea.
Okay. I won't.
So how did you get interested in the subject of bread and wine besides the obvious fact that most people eat and drink and get around tables with friends?
Before I started writing at all, when I was first putting in my first book proposal, I always tell this story and I wish I remember who said it to me. Someone said, this is the deal. You don't ever pick a topic based on like, oh, there's a gap in the market, or this will sell like hotcakes, or this will get me on Oprah, or this idea has marketing legs or whatever. You just, when you're talking about a book, you have to just write what you care about so deeply that you could talk about it night and day, dream about it, wrestle it to the ground, talk about it to every single person you see for about 2 years of your life. And if you don't pick something that you truly love and are compelled by, the reader will feel that. And then certainly because you write for about a year, but then you have to talk to a million people about it. You have to do a million radio interviews. You have to speak at conferences. You have to go to colleges. And if people sense that this is a topic that you stopped caring about a year ago, it doesn't work, you know? And so with each book, I've gone away and prayed and listened and walked and read and wrote and kind of said, like, what's that next thing that I could just like talk about in my sleep? And for that one specifically, I was in Colorado and I was speaking at an event, but I had a little downtime and I had brought a ton. It was just like pre-iPad days. So I brought a ton of like actual books with me. And I looked at the two stacks and it was a stack of like faith memoirs, people talking about the way they live their faith in their life. Very narrative, very memoir, very conversational. And then a stack of cookbooks. Mm-hmm. That's what I read. Those are my favorite things. I love to read cookbooks. I like read them in bed before I go to sleep. They're like my favorite thing.
Seriously?
I totally do. A huge stack of cookbooks.
And you don't get hungry reading those and then just go to sleep hungry? Does that not happen?
I'm always hungry.
So you like these two genres of books. What, like, let's talk about, I don't know anything about cookbooks. Okay. I eat the same four meals.
You're kidding.
No, seriously. I cook the same and I eat it. I would be terrible. It'd be a cookbook of grilled chicken, grilled turkey. That's it. That's all I eat.
It'd be a pamphlet.
Yeah. And then eggs. That's it. Seriously. Yeah. That's all I eat. So I have nothing to say about cookbooks, but talk to me like the narrative stories of faith that have really enriched you. Who's in the stack that you're reading?
Well, I mean, the number one, Anne Lamott's Traveling Mercies. That was basically, I read that right when I was graduating from college, and I would say it like that's the number one book that's affected me more than any other. And I reread it, and I give it away to people. That's my number one. Donald Miller's books have been a huge impact. Lauren Winter's Girl Meets God, especially, I think, is extraordinary. Elizabeth Gilbert, Eat, Pray, Love. A lot of people have strong negative feelings about it. Mm-hmm. She really changed the game for people who are writing about their own stories and specifically their own spiritual lives. I'm really thankful for the way that she did that. But then even some of the older ones, you know, Tolstoy's Confessions and Chesterton, and just anytime someone's talking about how their actual faith and life happened together. I'm not a theorist. Mm-hmm. So I can't get through a whole book about ideas. I need for there to be a story, and I need to know that it's connected with like the hardware and tactile nature of our life. And so those are the stories that really matter to me.
Talk to me about the hardware and tactile nature of what does that look like?
I think what I mean is I think there's a tendency in kind of certainly evangelical Protestant faith for our faith experience to be largely about things we can't see, largely. And we make the sacred and secular, we split it out into spiritual and material.
Yeah.
And we think like what really matters is what I'm thinking, what's going on in my brain, or very occasionally my heart, but not like my arms and legs, not my house, not my dishes, not my kids' toys. That's just plain old stuff. And we actually undervalue it, I think, but God made us in a physical, tactile, material world. And he gave us arms and legs, and he gave us a sense of smell, and he made trees and dirt and sand. And I think it matters. And so some of Bread and Wine is because I love to eat. And some of it's because I really believe in what God does around the table. But some of it is because I wanted to elevate the material world as equally sacred mm-hmm. as the invisible things we think and feel.
Yep.
So I think the actual table matters. I think the actual time we spend with our hands and forks and knives and bread and wine, I think that's sacred time. Mm-hmm.
You have a line in your book that the church is focused on the heart, the mind, and the soul instead of the fingers, the mouth, and the senses. And, you know, with the emphasis on fast food and faux food, as you describe it, how does that influence our spirituality? Like, if the church is just about high, like head, mind, heart, soul, that kind of stuff, instead of the tangible things, how does that influence the way we understand faith? Does it create that separation like you're talking about?
Well, I think some people, like when you say I go to church, what a lot of people mean is I walk into a building. I may or may not be relationally connected to anyone there, but I'm going to sit and a smart person is going to deliver information into my brain. Mm-hmm. And that's going to change me. Then I'm going to come back next week to be delivered more information. Where I would say it's certainly the way I grew up. Church is what happens around our dinner table every Thursday night. And it's also what happens when we go on Sunday morning, but they're not disconnected from one another. When we sit around the table together and we tell stories and we listen to each other and we pray and we cry, that's every bit a part of church life. And so I think the church as delivery system of information is a very limited, it's not a full representation of what church life is. Church life, I think inevitably, if it doesn't involve a table or a living room or a running trail, any place where people are connecting, not just receiving information.
Okay, so my church does small groups like every church in America seems to do. And we do meal, then we do prayer time, discussion, that kind of stuff. One time people showed up with fast food meals. We were in a hurry. Someone can't host it this week, so they just brought Subway or whatever they brought. Some people ate before they got there. It was by far the worst small group we've ever had. Why does that happen? Why does gathering on the table create something? What happens there? Is it some spiritual bonding that happens around tables?
Well, I mean, I think it's not a stretch to imagine that there could be an actual spiritual thing at work, especially if you look at the way, if you look specifically at the Lord's Supper, if you look at the Last Supper, I mean, it has to be, if we choose to look at scripture in such a way that what's the small details of the story important and can inform things. The fact that Jesus chose that ritual around that, you know, they weren't standing on the side of the road pulling bread out of their pockets. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I think there could be absolutely an actual spiritual thing that's happening. I also think there's just some kind of psychology about it. I think what we notice in our small group is when we're at the table, the conversation is really alive and vibrant. And then when we get to the quote unquote official part of the gathering, we leave the table and we go sit in the living room and it's generally awful. Mm-hmm. Like it starts to feel kind of stiff and like there's a program and everybody kind of locks up. And I think there's something about, the act of eating, of using your hands, of looking around the table, of passing things around to each other, that puts us at ease, that makes us able to connect in ways that we're not always able to other ways, in other settings. And so I think there is kind of an emotional, psychological aspect to what unlocks in people mm-hmm. when you gather around the table.
Yeah, it's interesting as you try to create clusters of guys in groups, that if you put a guy in a circle and say, let's talk about your feelings, you're getting nothing. But if there's something else they're doing, it seems to be far more conducive for that sort of community to happen.
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. And we joke about that a lot, that, and I would say for me, the table is so important and cooking and making home cooked meals is so important because I love it. I'm not saying every person who hates the kitchen must find great meaning and love there. My brother is a total motorcycle guy. That's like his deal. And, so he has a motorcycle shop with a bunch of guys downtown Chicago, and they work on bikes alongside one another. And if you were to say to him, like, hey, you know, when was the last time you had a significant conversation? I guarantee he would say, well, we were working on the bikes and it was quiet for a while.
Exactly.
And you wouldn't, like, it would never occur to him to say, like, hey, Eric, with whom I'm working on motorcycles, want to take a break and go to coffee and look each other in the eye and tell each other serious things? It's awful.
That sounds terrible.
Yeah, right? But in the course of doing what you love doing, shoulder to shoulder, the important things start to come out. And so that's the point. The point is, do what you love with people. And over time, you're kind of putting money in the bank for good things to happen relationally. So for my girlfriends and I, it's cooking. We spend time in the kitchen together, chopping and slicing and figuring things out. And that's where the important stuff comes out. For my brother, it's the motorcycle. For my husband, it's his band usually. But I think that's the core of it. It doesn't always have to be in the kitchen. It just has to be doing what you love.
Yeah. You mentioned Eucharist or communion earlier. And there's an understanding that when you take this special meal, the Lord's Supper, whatever you want to call it, there's a connection to God. Do you think that same sort of sacramental understanding of life is carried over into the normal table? Do you think there's a difference, or is that somehow connected?
Well, you know, and obviously people have such a wide range of views of how the actual sacraments fit into the whole. Mm-hmm. But I would say the fact that bread and wine are used as sacred symbols biblically means something for how we eat all the time. I think it has to.
In what way?
I think every time we eat, we are invited to experience connection with God. I think he made our bodies with need. And one thing I think is, you know, he made our bodies to need food. Like, that's part of the system. And I think that might be a built-in reminder to connect with him and with other people. Mm-hmm. If we could, like, wake up at 6 a.m. every morning, load in all the calories we need for the day, come back in 24 hours at 6 a.m., we might be missing several opportunities throughout the day to remember that God meets our needs and to remember that we're connected to one another through food and through the table. So I think there's an opportunity to experience a very deep spiritual reality every time we eat. I think most of us choose to miss it, mm-hmm. but I think the potential is there.
For those of us who choose to miss it or just don't choose to experience it, what are some ways that we can remember so that we don't miss it? What are some things that we can do, some practices that would help us to be present in that and see God in it?
You know, I think it's as, for a lot of us, it's as simple as getting to the table. Frankly, that's hard for our family. So I'm working on getting us back to the table more often. It's not going to happen three times a day, but even once a day is really good. And then once we're there to, invite God, acknowledge God's presence and the gift of food, and then to acknowledge the gift of presence of one another. Whether that's, you know, saying a prayer at the beginning of the meal and then creating space to ask a significant question. You know, we've been doing with our kids, and there's a million different ways to do it. The, you know, it's, I think technically the prayer of examine, but some people just put it in terms of like high, low, or best part of the, you know, the rose and the thorn, or there's all different ways to do it, but to practice listening to each other and, mm-hmm. and telling the truth to each other while we're eating, I think it's sort of a lost art. I think, you know, if your family's like ours, we unfortunately spend a lot of time just like grabbing stuff off the counter, running off to the next thing. And I think I'm learning to slow down our life a little bit and kind of wrangle us back to the table because I think it's significant.
Yeah. Now my family does the high-low game, but I much prefer the aptly 80s rock inspired title Rose and Thorn. I think
right?
That's awesome.
Right.
Do you have to sing the song while you do that?
You do. It's required.
Okay, girls. Every rose has its thorn. Okay. You talk about the table as a place where care and repair happens. Tell me more about how you experience healing through the voices of people that you gather on the table with.
You know, one of the guys in our small group, I just adore him. He works at our church, and I've known him for a long time, and he's single, and he works really, really, really hard. So he works long hours. And he said, just kind of in passing, you know, I don't cook. I'm never home to eat. But I know that once a week, someone will take care of me at your table. Mm-hmm. And that meant so much to me. There was another friend of ours we had a dinner party, and I was so excited about it. And it ended up where he had to come about 2 hours late because something went wrong. And he said, I would not have showed up at anybody else's table that night, but I knew that if I was in your home, I would feel taken care of and I would feel at home. And that's what I needed that night. And mm-hmm. those are like the biggest compliments you can give me. And so I think, to be really clear, it's never about cooking as performance art ever. It's never about a competition. It's never about the food being perfect. It's never about this extraordinary tablescape. It's about creating an atmosphere of family and safety, kind of mimicking, you know, I believe that friendship is God's greatest evidence of himself on earth. Mm-hmm. The way we know God is good is because of how good he makes people and how they love us the way he would love us in tactical ways. And so I think the table is a really easy meaningful way to demonstrate that love. When you sit someone down at your table and you say, I have made a space for you, that means I see you. That means it matters that you're here. It means I'm so glad you're not at home eating on your couch. It means your story matters. It means what's been hard about your day matters. For me, the table is the safe landing space. Like, I've got you. If you come to my table, I'm making space for you and I'm listening to you. And I think that's a sacred friendship kind of act.
Wow, that's good. I've heard you be very open and talk about the pain that you experience after a miscarriage and how you experience healing around the table, in community. What did that look like for you?
You know, I think the nature of grief is that you always feel like you're the only one. Joy is the opposite. When you're happy, you just assume everybody in the world is happy. When you're like, when you get engaged, all you see are like diamond rings on other people's fingers.
Exactly,
like the world is so happy. Mm-hmm. But when you're sick, or when you lose another baby, or when your heart is broken, or when you lose a job you loved, you just think like, oh, everybody else is just rocking it right now. And I'm so deeply alone. So then there's two problems. You're heartbroken and you feel isolated. And I felt so deeply alone in that season. And when I look back at the times that I didn't feel alone, it's when we sat at the table. And I mean, I know I was a difficult person to be around in that season. I'm sure I told the same story 18 times in a row. I cried a lot. I was angry. And the people who loved me kept saying that they kind of held space for me at the table. Like, yeah, you're just a disaster right now, but you still have a place at our table. Mm. You still belong. We're going to listen to that darn story one more time. We're going to watch you cry those same tears again. And they made me feel like I wasn't alone. And I think, again, what more do you want when your heart is broken than to know that you're not alone and that there's still space for you in your ugliness?
Yeah. Why do you think we feel alone in grief compared to, you know, connected to everyone when we have joy? What is it about grief that makes us feel so alone?
I don't know. I think I don't know exactly. I just know that that's how it feels to me. I just know that. Mm-hmm. And then the most meaningful thing is when all of a sudden someone can reach through and make you feel not alone. When we were, had multiple miscarriages and seasons of infertility, every time someone said me too, I was just genuinely shocked and it mattered so much. Like, oh, okay. I'm not the only person carrying this grief. That felt so valuable to me. So I think one of the reasons that it's important to tell our stories, both the good parts and the not good parts, is because the not good parts kind of keep people company in their grief. I think that's important.
Hmm. Well, I've got a couple of friends in our small group that are big fans of yours. And so when they found out that you were going to come on the show, they were very excited. And one of them made the point that you seem to be a kind of person that finds beauty in so many things that many of us just miss. So you're the type of person that sees beauty in a lot of things that fly under the radar. And I don't think I'm going to start like having people write my questions for me, but she wanted to know, is that something that you were just like born with, or is that something you've cultivated?
Well, that's a really nice thing to say. Thank you. Some of this,
I didn't say it, so I'll pass it on.
Tell her. Yes.
Yeah,
tell
I'll pass
her.
It on her. Okay.
This is like a whole different rabbit trail entirely, but I am a major, major, major fan of the Enneagram. Are you familiar with the Enneagram?
You know, I've got a Richard Rohr coming up, hopefully,
yeah,
in a couple of weeks. I know he's a big fan of it. Ian Cron, which I know you're friends with Ian. Yeah. So I have some familiarity with it.
So I'm like a true crazed fan.
Do you have a tattoo of it on your arm somewhere?
That would be true. But I'm close. If I was going to get a tattoo, I would absolutely get an Enneagram one.
Oh, wow.
So the type that I am is called the enthusiast. It's the type seven. And at their worst, an unhealthy seven is just like gluttonous and sort of rabidly accumulating experiences, more food, more drinks, more shopping, more going places, staying up later, getting up earlier, push, 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 go, go, go. Like bingy, just excessive. But a seven at his or her best sees the beauty in everything and is absolutely overflowing with joy at the ordinary beauty in life. And so I try hard not to be that excessive kind of ravenous mm-hmm. way of living. And at my best, if I'm living well, if I'm connected well with God, if I'm practicing disciplines that keep me kind of in shape and focused, I do kind of delight in the ordinary. I always joke that like I'm so incredibly easily pleased. Tiny, tiny little things make me unreasonably happy.
Really? Yeah. Now, I've heard you quote the Mary Oliver poem where she talks about being a bride married to amazement, which is a great line. What do you think it means to be a bride? Or I guess, can we be groom if we're going to include the gentleman in this one, such as myself? What does it mean to be married to amazement?
You know, I think they always say, you know, whatever you're looking for, you'll find. It's all there, right? If you decide to search the world over for evil, plenty of it, you'll find it. If you decide to search it for injustice, you'll find it. If you decide to search it for beauty, you will also find it. If you decide to, Glennon Melton, who I adore, wrote, you know, this great book, Carry On Warrior. And one of the phrases that she uses is perspective and spectacles. And she talks about when she gets out of whack, when she feels ungrateful or like things are unfair or that she doesn't have what she needs or everybody else is getting better stuff, she puts on her perspectacles and they allow her to see what's true, which is that God is good and he's been good to her and he's given her everything she needs. And I think a lot of it is you see whatever you want to see. If you focus your eyes on goodness, you will find it and all of a sudden you'll just be stunned at how replete it is. The world is just stuffed with it. And if you focus on brokenness or evil or darkness or whatever, there's plenty of that. But I think it comes down to, I practice, one of the things I do kind of in my just daily spiritual practice is I think about stuffing my pockets with beautiful things, just like a mental image, like that's so beautiful, put it in my pocket. That's so beautiful, put it in my pocket. And then I get to the end of the day and I put it all out and I think, look at this extraordinary world. Remember when my son said that. Remember how the tree looked as the sun was setting. Remember the bite of that extraordinary sandwich. Remember, and I just, really? I really do. And
so
this
is all for the rose and the thorn game, isn't it? So you've got a whole list of roses that you can mention.
I kind of do. I just think the world is so deeply, genuinely good and beautiful. I think there is so much. You know, when I watch kids play with each other and just like cry laughing, our kids were just like busting each other up last night, belly laughing in their beds. You think there's so much goodness still. And I get it. I get that it's a rough time to be, you know, reading the news, but still underneath it all, it's so beautiful.
Yeah. Well, my last couple of shows have been talking about Ferguson. So they've been a little bit on the dark side because it's just really tough subject. And so it's great to hear this, this great positive message that you're infusing with us of this great idea of being able to store up all these beautiful things in amazement. And so I want to think through this idea more that you're going through the day and basically taking little snapshots of a beautiful thing. And you're really going to go back home at the night and go through, yeah, I saw these five beautiful things and you're just going to focus on that.
I thank God for those things. Just, yeah. Thank you for that moment last night where the kids were belly laughing. And thank you for that moment when I asked Aaron for help and he helped me and I felt weak and then I felt loved. Thank you for that moment. Thank you for the beautiful grapes that we bought at the store last night and how good they were to eat with Henry in the car on the way home. Thank you for it. Like just again, just because it's material doesn't mean it's not spiritual. Those grapes that, you know, those grapes were a gift and we shared them and we laughed and you know, like there's just, you know, obviously there is so much broken in our world, especially right now. I totally understand that. At the same time, people are having new, fresh, beautiful babies. People are falling in love. People are learning to walk with Jesus in new ways. People are forgiving their spouses of old things. Like both are always true. And it's easy to focus on only the darkness. I get it. But if we can become people who are like on the hunt, a friend of mine uses the term hope mongering, that she's just always looking for hope. I think that's a beautiful way to live. Just the darkness is obvious. You don't have to search for it. It finds us. It's there, right? It's like shouting at us on the internet all the time. People are living it all the time. It's harder sometimes to train your eyes for beauty and for goodness and for honesty and simplicity and God's fingerprints. But when your eyes start to become oriented that way, the world is just, it'll just blow your mind with beauty.
Yeah, that's good. Rick Warren was in DFW because, as you said, everyone needs to spend a good bit of their time in DFW a couple of years ago. And this is before his son committed suicide. And he was having this dinner for pastors and someone invited me and he started talking about how the same weekend that his book, Purpose Driven Life or whatever, sold that's 30 millionth copy or whatever, making it the best-selling book of all time. Something really tragic with the son having to be maybe institutionalized or something like that happened very same time. And I might have the specifics of that story a little bit off, but his basic point was people think of highs and lows as that they're separate things, but he says it's more like a train track where you have highs and lows at the exact same time. And so I love this idea of being able to store those things up and to be appreciative and grateful for what you have, because it seems that if you're a discontent person, if you are not grateful for what you have, you're never going to see the beauty in it. And it's almost like you can't be grateful and thankful and have this envy of what you don't have. It seems like it's the greatest enemy we have to being content is envy, right?
Oh, I think absolutely. And I think some of what you're, it's sort of like a defensive move. If I walk through my life very intentionally filling my pockets with the true beauty of the world, then when I look over and see what somebody else has, my hands are so full, right?
Yeah.
I'm not like, oh, look what she has. I'm like, you know what though? I have so much. And not like materially, but like I have been witness to so much beauty. How could I be envious when I've been witness to such extraordinary goodness and beauty just yesterday, you know? So the more you can kind of cram your mind and your heart with gratitude for what already is, the less empty you feel when someone else gets something you thought you wanted.
Hmm. Do you think that helps someone see the beauty in a very simple meal of, you know, you talk in your book about it could be a, you know, frozen pizza that you just warm up or some microwave dinner that, which I'm assuming you're probably not saying microwave dinner because as a food person, I'm sure that would make part of you die. But a very simple, not fancy meal, there's still beauty and there's still God's goodness in that.
Totally. And I think, you know, some of the reason I put so many recipes in Bread and Wine is because I wanted to demystify the idea of fancy food. We don't eat fancy food. We just eat food. Mm-hmm. And it's not, and we do eat frozen pizza. I'm a crazy pizza person. I will eat any pizza. It can be frozen. It can be from a gas station. Like, I love it.
Really?
Yeah, I love it. And that it doesn't
sounded
have to
very
be
condescending
fancy.
From me. I apologize.
No, but it's true. But anybody, you know, every once in a while people say, you know, so you must just be like wearing an apron and cooking amazing home cooked meals all day long. We absolutely eat takeout. I eat crackers a lot because I love them. I love cheese and crackers for dinner. It's my favorite thing.
That's awesome.
When Aaron's gone, I have goldfish
cheese and crackers.
What
kind of cracker do you go with? Do you
have a specific... Well, I eat a lot of goldfish because the kids goldfish.
My kids
I totally
goldfish.
Do.
I hate them
so
much.
Do you really? Oh, no, they're delicious.
Fruit snacks. I can't stop eating those.
But... Oh, see, Aaron's like that too. Aaron likes fruit leather. He eats the kids' fruit leather all the time. And yeah. I just destroy. I actually have gotten to the point where adults pretend they don't like goldfish. But if you put them out at a party, they will absolutely eat every single last one. Yes. And I do it all the time.
Okay. So you're eating goldfish and cheese.
I do. But I think again, it's about, if you cultivate an expectation, so it's not about like, oh, I have such an extraordinary life. No, the actual world happening to all of us is extraordinary. Mm-hmm. It's for all of us. And you can enjoy as much of it as I can. And it's just like, how much of that goodness and beauty can we cram in our pockets mm-hmm. every day? And so that, I think that takes away that sense of what she has and what I have. The goodness of this world is available to all of us mm-hmm. if you decide to see it.
So when you started just cramming these little moments of goodness into your pocket, which I imagine you wearing cargo pants for some reason doing that.
Yeah, tons of pockets.
Yes, lots of pockets. Okay, first of all, what did you start doing that? How long ago was that?
I think the image has been around in my mind at least since high school.
Really? Mm-hmm. What was the genesis of this?
You know, I think actually going all the way back to our original conversation, I... went through a pretty circuitous spiritual journey where I was sort of systematically like, I don't want to be a part of this community. I don't want to be a part of my church. I don't want to be like that. I'm not sure I'm done with this. I'm not kind of systematically pushing away different parts of my evangelical Protestant Midwestern upbringing. And what I was left with largely was literature and poetry and music. Mm-hmm. And so for a long time, I was not, I wasn't reading the Bible. I wasn't reading Christian books. I certainly wasn't listening to Christian music, but I was reading and listening to tons of very beautiful music and literature and poetry. And, what it led me back to largely was nature. Mm. And I was living in California at the time. And, it's hard to not believe in a loving God at the beach. It's hard to look out at the Pacific Ocean and say, this probably just randomly happened and no loving hand created this extraordinary. Like, why would this be so extraordinary, right? Yeah. And so for a long time, I didn't want to go to church because it made me crazy. But every Sunday night I went to the ocean. And I considered it my own little church service. And I would never make a case for sitting by yourself at the beach being a long-term plan instead of going to church.
Yeah.
But it was what I needed for that season. Mm-hmm. I was over-churched, to say the least, and mm-hmm. going to a Christian college, which was kind of making me nuts. But I kept coming back to the ocean and thinking, a good God made this. I can't escape that. And so, nature and literature and music and poetry brought me back around to Bible and theology and church and community. And, so I will always go back to those places whenever I feel shaky. Those will always kind of bring me back to, they always point me back to God.
What part of California were you living in?
Santa Barbara. I went to Westmont College. It's really easy to believe in God in Santa Barbara. It's like the best place on earth.
Yeah. Yeah. I've got a trip to Malibu in a couple of weeks, and it's very easy to believe in God right there too.
Right. It's amazing. Yeah.
Okay. So the suggestion is everyone move to the beach and then you'll be a devout follower of God.
I would be. Totally. Great. I'd be a much better Christian if I lived at the beach.
Well, compared to Chicago, that's not really, no, I'm kidding. Hey, Shauna, thank you so much for your time. It's been a lot of fun talking with you. Hey, you've got a new book. You're going to start writing in the fall. Is that right?
I am. On Tuesday. I'm starting.
You're starting on Tuesday.
Yes.
What is the first paragraph you're going to write? Do you have any idea?
Oh, I can't wait. I'm so excited about it. It's going to be called Present Over Perfect.
Oh, and nice.
Thank you. The subtitle, it won't be this because it's too clunky, but in my mind, the subtitle is A Spiritual Journey from Exhaustion and Comparison to Passion and Compassion. Just the idea that a lot of us have found our faith to be one more thing that we're doing poorly. One more thing to feel guilty about, and our lives are full of pushing and earning and achieving both in our faith lives and in the rest of our lives. And we're exhausted. Mm-hmm. And, or at least I am. Mm-hmm. And I want to reimagine my faith as a place of great rest mm-hmm. and grace and compassion, not, exhausting, competitive, achievement oriented living, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm really excited about it. I tend to choose a topic that I want to understand more, not one that I've, you know, that's nailed.
Yeah.
So this is one, like, I want to live this for a year and write about it along the way and then come out changed on the other side.
That sounds good. I look forward to checking that out in probably 2 years or so when it actually gets out.
Yeah, probably 2 years.
Okay, so as a good daughter, would you like 30 seconds to promote your father's book that just came out?
Yes, you're so nice. It's called Simplify. It's so good. And I got to edit it, which was so great. It was a really fun thing to do.
How did that go? Dad, this paragraph is rough here. What are you talking? How did that go?
Oh, totally. He loves feedback. He had me go through it several times with a red pen, and he's more even critical than I am. There's stuff that I was like, that's fine. I can roll with that. He was like, I can't. There's a better way to say that, you know? Oh. So we had a great time working on it, but it is the most, it's a practical handbook for how to kind of organize your life around what you believe. So we're going to talk about marriage. We're going to talk about your calendar. We're going to talk about your work life. We're going to talk about your relationships and your ability to forgive and your spiritual practices. It's like a super practical handbook for living, kind of making a life that matches the values you carry, which is sometimes hard to do. So it's great. I love it.
Sounds like a great book too. Well, we've got a lot of things we need to be reading. Shauna, thanks for your time. It's been a lot of fun talking with you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.